people came and said, we want to come and give our condolences to you on the demise of that Maje Taklid. In other words, we are recognizing you as the Maje Taklid.
Right.
What is also interesting is some of his students used to say that there's usually, when the Maje Taklid becomes a Maje Taklid, he releases a book of practical laws.
That's right. Yes.
Imam Khomeini did not release a book of practical laws.
This is another thing.
His students actually went and published these for him. He said, if you, you know, in the sense that he didn't want to.
This is what we call a risala, isn't it? This is something that you
indeed
receive from a religious authority to give you guidance as a Muslim, how to be a good
indeed
Muslim.
Indeed, the practical laws of Islam.
Practical laws of Islam.
And
but the students go ahead and publish
the
it.
Students go and publish
from
it.
From his seminars. That's
from his seminary.
Yeah,
saying that, look, we want to promote you. Mm. We want to get let people know that you are the Maje Taklid. But he said, no, you want to do it, you do it at your own expense.
Mm.
And he did not want to come into this environment of being identified.
Yeah, he doesn't show, you know, as you say, this you know, desire to be, you know, something amongst the people, you know, is something that you come out of a worldly desire. This is a man who has completely shunned the world
indeed
from what it is.
And you see, within the discussions of jurisprudence regarding the conditions how a person can be classified as a Maje Taklid, Imam Khomeini, in his conditions of when a person becomes a Maje Taklid, puts in as a etiyat-e wajib, it's usually said, a compulsory caution, that the person who is being identified as a Maje Taklid, he should not have worldly aspirations.
That's right.
He should not have worldly desires.
No worldly aspirations.
You know, and that meant that Imam Khomeini was saying, even with the whole handful of Islamic knowledge that you have, and you've come to the stage of that you could be identified as a Maje Taklid, be careful, the shaitan can still come on you and
that's
say,
right,
aren't I going to be identified by the people now?
I mean, this gnosis that Imam Khomeini has, you know, as you say, from the fact that he's also a mystic, and he, I mean, this is something I find unique in his life, that I find this very rare in any other personality, that he's constantly consulting the Quran, constantly looking for God's pleasure, seeing that, finding the consent that, is this something I should do that would please you
and
would be for the sake of Islam?
And it is. You see, we'll discuss later on of Imam Khomeini's exile from Iran. But in that period of time, there's a beautiful story about Imam Khomeini.
Sure.
That, you know, because being a Maje Taklid, you also have the responsibility to collect collect khums, which is the Islamic tax.
Yes, yes, yes.
On behalf of the Imam-e-Zaman, you know,
right,
Imam of our age.
Imam of the age, yes.
Now,
yes,
there's a good story about it, that there's a collector in Isfahan,
right,
who collects money on behalf of Imam Khomeini as khums collector.
Right.
And usually these collectors are given the opportunity to take some money out of this collection as expenses.
Right.
So this collector, he would write to Imam Khomeini saying, can you please increase that amount of expenses that I can have in collecting the money? So Imam Khomeini replies to him saying, no, what you've been appointed is more than enough. So another visitor is going to Najaf, so he asks him verbally to ask Imam Khomeini to increase my provision. So Imam Khomeini tells this visitor to go back and tell the person that what he has is enough. So on the third occasion, he writes to Imam Khomeini saying that if, now it becomes a if, not can you, it becomes a if, saying if you do not increase my collection, then I will let people know that you do not qualify to be a Maje Taklid.
Unbelievable.
Now, you listen to Imam Khomeini's answer.
Right, right.
Imam Khomeini's answer is that if you do this, you would do me a favor in front of Imam-e-Zaman.
Very nice.
Now, he feels himself as a person always responsible to his Imam.
His Imam.
If he's collecting khums, he's not collecting khums for his pocket.
No,
he's collecting khums for the Imam.
Very
so
nice.
He's saying, if you reduce this burden of the khums on my shoulder, then you will be doing a favor to me.
A favor to me.
Not belittling me.
No, that's very nice.
So, you know, it's really interesting to know how Imam Khomeini always used his opportunities to knock his personal desires for the betterment or the promotion of godly.
Because the natural response for anyone in that kind of situation would have been turning around and saying, who are you to say to me, you know, that...
Not only that, he might turn around and say, okay, how much do you want? So I don't lose my position.
I lose my reputation.
Yeah.
Quite.
Okay,
quite.
I'll silence you. Let me give you another 10,000 or 15,000. He didn't care.
No.
He said,
was
okay,
not interested.
Take people away from
okay.
me.
Okay, okay.
Take them away from
take
me.
Take them away from
it
me.
Makes no difference because I'm answerable to God, not to you.
Type very nice.
And so, you know, Imam Khomeini had always that kind of self-building that it should be whatever you do should be for God. Whatever fight you have.
It's the humility, the humbleness that
shows through
it.
Whoever you're afraid of, it should be God.
It should be God.
Not he who's going to put pressure on you.
Very nice.
Like the Shah, he continuously put pressure on Imam Khomeini.
Yeah.
To the extent that in 1963, when all these things were happening,
yeah,
Imam Khomeini called Shah a wretched, miserable man.
And he certainly was.
And in doing so, the following day, because this happened on the 3rd of June,
sure,
1963,
yes,
on the 5th of June, 1963, Imam Khomeini was arrested.
Yeah.
And when he was arrested, there's huge, huge demonstrations.
And we have to say that that wretched, miserable man, those words used by Imam Khomeini are not used in the sense that, you know, trying to degrade his reputation as a king. He's doing it in the fact of the akhirah, that you are a wretched, miserable individual on the day of judgment in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You've lost it all.
But Shah got offended. He sent in his army.
Right. And this is where they ransacked Fazia, wasn't it?
They
threw ulama off the roofs.
They did.
Rooftops.
And for 2 days, there were public demonstration and
denunciation. There was, yes.
And then Imam Khomeini was sent in exile locally.
Yeah.
And on the, it was on the, and the whole thing about the 15th of Khodad movement started, which is the 3rd of June.
That's right.
And the whole fact that so many people, there were almost 400 people killed.
That's right.
In those demonstrations.
Yes.
And continuously, Imam Khomeini was kept under pressure.
There was a lot of bloodshed in those days. A lot of bloodshed by the regime.
But you see, they tried to put Imam Khomeini in such a pressure that public felt that Imam Khomeini was no longer around to voice their defense.
Defense, yes.
And Imam Khomeini continued to provide that defense
for
the public. So much so that, for example, when Shah was preparing for his 2,500th crowning anniversary
strange ceremony that
kingdom of
baffled
of
the rest of the world. What was that all about?
Well, they all came looking at a fool.
Yeah.
And the fools came to look at the fool. You know, you had Carter there, you had other people fooling around with this fool.
And the point that we have to make here, of course, with that ludicrous ceremony that was done round about 1977, I think it was, wasn't it? Was it round about that time, I think, he did that particular ceremony? But whatever it was, as you say, he had all these dignitaries called in, champagne flown from Paris by air, and the most expensive meals provided at the expense of the poverty of the people.
Yeah, they continued to do that. And Imam did not keep quiet on that situation.
Yeah.
Imam Khomeini put his foot down and condemned them.
Yeah.
And thereupon, that ultimate final exile of Imam Khomeini to Turkey, and then to Iraq
then to France, for 14 years
started its progression. And all these things were Imam Khomeini's main reasoning was that he will take whatever pressure the world would throw at him, as long as in the process of taking these pressures, God was being satisfied.
That's right. We also have to mention here the fact that, of course, during these pressures and these very difficult times that were being put on Imam Khomeini, although, as you say, he's now recognized by the people as the authority to lead them in terms of leading the Muslim Ummah, guiding them, as you say, as you quoted from verse 1771, you know, to be with the Imam of the time. But at the same time, he lost his elder son, didn't he? This sacrifice was also an indication to the people that how far Imam Khomeini was prepared to go in this path, that he was prepared to endure everything that was possible.
Indeed, and again, as we look, if we link back to what was aspiring him to do this, were the issues of Karbala, for example. He would have in his mind, well, I'm only losing one son, but my Imam lost so many sons on the field of Karbala.
Yes.
You know, so it's a continuous personalizing of those things which were a natural existence in the Shia opinion.
That's right. Because this is what we're really talking about at the end of the day, that principally the ethos and the politics and the this resistance movement that comes out of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala, and that's the defining role for Imam Khomeini.
Indeed.
That it is a movement about Imam Hussein, and it's about guiding Muslims on the path of Imam Hussein to understand that movement, that way of not only resistance but to gain your rights from an oppressive regime.
And throughout Imam Khomeini's discourse on standing for your rights, he always used Karbala as the principles from where it is generating.
Yeah.
You know, for example, when Shah asks him in 1963, where is your army?
Yeah, yeah. That's
and
very
he says,
famous. Yes,
he said,
yes.
My army is in the laps of its mothers.
Yes, right.
What was this lap that he was talking about?
Yeah.
He was talking about the same Zainabiyyah.
MashaAllah, that's beautiful. That is very beautiful.
You know, that the ultimate message taker.
That
if the mother is given the opportunity to raise the kids properly, then they will not ever forget the message of Karbala.
That's true. Absolutely, Sayyidina.
And in that sense, what was Imam Khomeini foreseeing in this situation? Yes. When was the revolt that we're talking about? 1963.
Yes, yes.
When was the revolution? 1979.
Nine.
How many years? 16 years.
16 years, yes.
One generation of kids.
That's right.
You can see the foresight of Imam Khomeini.
This is the extraordinary thing about Imam Khomeini.
Now, Imam Khomeini is
He's taking it from the lessons and the legacy of Karbala.
Indeed. Yes. Indeed. And he's seeing that, you know, a child which is 2 years old, 3 years old in his mother's lap, 16 years later, he's 19, standing for Imam Khomeini's movement.
That's right.
5 years old, 21. So you can see Imam Khomeini's foresight. It's not just, I have kids in mother's laps. I have children who are going to stand to fight the Shah.
Sure.
So, you know, 1963's movement was a whole educational factor. Because from 1963 to 79, Imam Khomeini is training his, not training himself now. He's training the future.
He's training the future generations to make that resistance.
Exactly. And he depended on the backbone of the training was going to be the mothers. And I bring back again that evil concept that exists in the Muslim Ummah.
Yes.
That the Wahhabis are directly targeting the education of women.
Exactly.
So that lap of education is destroyed.
That's right. Because at the end of the day, you know, this is what we always remind ourselves and acknowledge at all times on the day of Ashura, that it is Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, who is the heroine of Karbala. Because if it wasn't for her, you know, Karbala wouldn't be Karbala for the way it would have been understood for generations.
Alhamdulillah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put his own components there.
He did.
You know, it's an interesting thing to say Karbala would not be Karbala. This would not have opened without it being this way anyway.
Exactly.
You see?
Exactly.
So these are the prerequisites of the event that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had established that Imam Hussein was going to come with the whole consortium of people.
Even after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, at the outset, acknowledges the role of the women in the resistance in bringing down the Shah.
That on its side, and the fact that every time Imam Khomeini said, our movement would not be our movement without Ashura.
Exactly.
You see, and you can look at the same relationship. What did the Shah, Muhammad Reza Shah's father, try to do?
Exactly.
He tried to stop Ashura from coming in the public.
Exactly. He wanted to put a public ban on it.
And in some places, they destroyed Husseinias where events were taking place on Ashura.
Yeah.
So you could see that the whole thing of the Islamic movement is as it develops on the back of continuous endorsement of Muharram, continuous endorsement of Ashura. And that's why when Imam Khomeini compares the Shah, he compares him with Yazid.
Exactly.
Compares him with Yazid and defines him as a Yazid of the time.
Exactly.
So people can kind of picturize the confrontation that we're in. That there's a Yazid of the time, the Yazid of that time confronted Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Yazid of this time is confronting Imam Hussein's servants.
Exactly. And the people easily got that image in their mind by the atrocities that the Shah kept committing over and over again in terms of you know, banning. And you know, it's very famously that he tried to stop the Ashura mornings again. And Imam Khomeini said, nobody stays in the house. Everybody comes out onto the street.
Yes, that's near to the time of the revolution. But you see, what is really interesting is that whilst Imam Khomeini is using the days of Ashura as important, Shah's regime is trying to convert the Muslim community towards anti-Islamic values.
That's right. You see, I mean, this was the purpose of that silly, ludicrous celebration of 2,500 years of mourning. He was trying to take them back to a pre-Islamic age.
Pre-Islamic, and then, but then during this period, you know, you go to Tehran, you've got cabarets, you've got bars, you've got
the
some
corruption.
People used to say that haram meat was more easier accessible than halal meat.
And the filthy films that were being shown on the cinemas.
The whole aspirations were to make the people anti-Islam in their in their livelihood.
Yeah.
So much so that these Islamic values did not have any essence in their existence.
But as you say, with the parallel with the Ataturk thing that had happened in Turkey,
indeed,
they were doing it at a much more aggressive level
indeed
here
they
in
were.
Iran.
But then because of that, the confrontation with the ulema was even more apparent.
Apparent, yeah.
That because during Ataturk's time, it was one-off movement which removed everything as a change of government.
That's right.
Here they were trying to change the whole culture of the
city. The whole culture, yes. This was much more
dangerous.
And that's
what Imam Khomeini kept on picking up in his in his continuous confrontation. It was not one issue politics that Imam Khomeini was working with. It was more wider. Wherever the issues of confronting Islam started, he would take his extrapolation of Islamic values to confront them.
That's right.
And you see that throughout. And, you know, it so happened that once the Prime Minister of the Shah, his name was Prime Minister Hassan Ali Mansour, he called Imam Khomeini over to discuss with him that, you know, he should not be so aggressive with the Shah and he should apologize to the Shah. Imam Khomeini refused. And that type of arrogance to kind of get the ulema under control. And, you know, the whole purpose of it was to try and show that, look, we can control the ulema if we want to. It wasn't long before he was assassinated, mind you.
Right.
And those who realized that this was a huge insult to the Shia Ummah, you know, replied back in the rightful in the manner which removed this evil.
Well, it shows the nature of the stooges who were in power. But the other thing is that we can't ignore the fact that the Americans had helped the Shah establish a very vicious secret police here in Iran, which was called SAVAK, and because of those atrocities that police were committing day in and day out, you know, on the ordinary citizens of the public, that, you know, the image of Yazid was, you know, quite imprinted on
indeed
the people's mind.
And also the fact that, you know, ordinary people in their own places who were being tortured and things, there was a calculated strategy in eliminating the lower ulema levels. You know, there were students who were being kidnapped and tortured
that's
and killed.
Right.
There were lower ranked ayatollahs who were kidnapped, tortured.
Mm.
You know, you had, for example, Ayatollah Talaghani, who was tortured.
That's right.
His family were tortured.
The students of Imam Khomeini, like, you know, Rafsanjani, Sayyid Khamenei, many other persons, Ayatollah Behishti, so many others.
All these people
were in prison.
The younger ulema, clerics of the time, they were all penalized for supporting Imam Khomeini providing the public with some type of guidance around what the Islamic movement is against the Shah.
True.
And, you know, you got to remember this as a very important thing, that it was a field movement. It was really and truly the people's movement, because everything that Imam Khomeini talked about was talked to people from the masajids.
Right.
Everything that Imam Khomeini talked to the people about was represented to people in their local environment.
Sure.
So, you know, it was at that level of the people's level. It's something which the communists tried to hijack.
Yes. That's also a very important aspect, because the Tudor party, the Marxist party, of course, they were established around the time when the Allies who were fighting the Nazis, you know, overtook Iran. But of course, the Russians were establishing their own communist parties here, which had a kind of Islamic guise.
But you see,
the
Tudor party was the biggest communist party in the Muslim world in Iran.
That's right.
So we can maybe discuss that as a discussion regarding Imam Khomeini
in a later program, definitely.
But to conclude, that what Imam Khomeini did up to his time of exile was that he really and truly made Shah, forced the Shah into either exiling him or setting down, stepping down himself.
Very nice, yes.
And that was the ultimate thing. That's why in 1964. Imam Khomeini is exiled to Turkey.
Yeah, I think, say, what you touch on is an extremely significant point, and the fact that Imam Khomeini, God may God bless him, is setting the standard right from the beginning in terms of the fact that he's standing on principle, standing for the sake of the pleasure of Allah, you know, keeping us in line with the infallibles like the movement of Imam Hussein, and at the same time, he's setting himself as the example so that the people see from his sacrifice, even from his own loss of his own son and so on and so forth, that, you know, this is a no-nonsense man. You know, this is somebody who's really and truly for the sake of God's movement.
And followable. Mm-hmm. So you can really say, in conclusion to that, that Imam Khomeini is someone who is followable.
Yeah, right.
And that what he says, he will do.
He will do.
And therefore, if you follow him, there's no problem. You can do the same sacrifice as he's already done in front of you. Like Imam Hussein did.
Right.
To other, show to people that I can sacrifice my son, so you can sacrifice yours as well.
That's great. Thank you very much for that, Sayyid, for that very valuable contribution today. And I hope, listeners, you enjoyed and benefited from the program. And we'll certainly carry on with this biographical account of Imam Khomeini's very revolutionary movement here in Iran in the next program. But may the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Underwater of the North Sea.
Part 1.
I learned to swim in the murky waters of the North Sea, where lie the remnants of 5 centuries of naval battles. I found this submerged world even more fascinating as it was hidden. Through diving, I understood the extent of the military debris left behind by the 20th century. Because in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, the Allies deliberately sunk ships transporting hundreds of millions of tons of chemical weapons. Today, we are holding more and more commemorations for both world wars, while under the sea, the metallic fuselages holding these substances are corroding. If we don't take action, scientists predict an unprecedented catastrophe.
The munitions are silent killers that are basically the chemical releases from them are drifting in the ocean as we speak today.
Why were these chemical weapons dumped in the sea? What action can we take to protect man and the environment before it's too late? Because this dreadful legacy is ready to resurface as if the salt water was preventing history's scars to heal. At the start of the 20th century, the North Sea is the confrontation site for the industrial nations. France, the Netherlands, the UK, Belgium, and Germany battle over commercial and political geoeconomics. Europe's first industrial war sees the development of new weapons. Like the submarine, the airplane, tanks, and deadly chemical weapons. Replacing the usual racket of infantry attacks, I imagined the deathly silence of a 168-ton green cloud descending upon the French front lines and instantly gassing around 15,000 soldiers. The Germans used chlorine gas as a weapon for the first time in 1915, close to Ypres in Flanders. The world had just entered the realms of chemical weapons. During World War I, all warring nations developed gas weapons. Soldiers protect themselves with sophisticated masks. The substances can be detected by their odors. Phosphorus smells like freshly cut hay. Mustard gas, also called Yprite, in memory of its deadly use in Ypres, smells like garlic. Lewisite has the scent of geraniums and hydrogen cyanide, evokes bitter almonds. These olfactory clues will be corrected by German chemists, and the next generation of gases will kill with complete discretion. I wondered what had become of these toxic arsenals following armistice. I was surprised to discover that access to French military archives was forbidden. On the other hand, in the archives of the Belgian Royal Army, I found a document from May 1919 advising war ministries to clear their territory of abandoned ammunition and notably of asphyxiation gases. It says that the most effective way is to sink this ammunition in the sea. Ministers ordered the 35,000 tons of chemical weapons to be dumped on the sandbanks of Paardenmarkt, a stone's throw away from the swanky Nacka beach. Because this location is very close to a densely populated zone, today it is the best documented in Europe.
The dump site has been there for a long time. It has been there since 1919, when chemical munitions that were found in Belgium after the end of the First World War, it was mainly German munition. A lot of accidents happened, explosions, so they wanted to get rid of this dangerous munition. And they chose to dump it very close to the shore, so they could use small boats. They would not have to go very far, but because it was quite dangerous to transport a lot of chemical munition over a long distance.
...35,000 tons of chemical weapons, the equivalent of more than 1,000 of our current lorries, a few hundred meters away from the industrial port of Zeebrugge and Nacka Beach. In addition to the danger of this proximity, the depth of the site is extremely weak, with some of the depot zones less than 1 meter away. Today, the currents have covered the bombs in a layer of sand and sea sediment. Is it the opacity of the North Sea or the hazards of turbulent history that have made the site disappear from memories?
It was finished, I think, in spring 1920, and then everybody forgot about it. Until in the 1970s, they were doing maintenance works for the harbor of Zeebrugge, and then a dredging vessel hit upon big obstacles on the seafloor, let's say.
Today, the official position is that those responsible for this dumping were not aware of the potential dangers. Yet from 1919 onwards, the mayor of Kanake was warned about the chemical dumping on the beaches of his commune. He writes a letter to the war ministry in which he outlines his concerns for the health of coastlines and the future of coastline fishing. The ministry responds dryly. It's the fastest solution, and the dangers you allude to will not occur. Yet now we know that their deterioration in water can increase harmfulness.
The major danger comes from the Clark compound, from the arsenic compound, because also most of the breakdown products, when the product breaks down because it's in water, are equally toxic. They can stay toxic for a very long time. Mustard gas, it's not a gas. None of these are really gases. It's like a liquid, it's a very thick liquid. And if it's in the seawater for a long time, it will become brittle and hard. So it will become a sort of lump. But if this lump is very toxic, but it stays in place. You know, it's a problem, but it's very localized. It doesn't spread very far.
For security reasons, it's forbidden to fish and to throw down anchors in the zone. But sailing is not forbidden there, and I still see my childhood sailing school drifting around there. The biggest threat would be a shipwreck in the zone. In 2001, a ship container was washed up close to the site. If the ship's bow had turned over the Partenmark sands, the boat would have caused an explosion, contaminating the coasts of Belgium, Holland, and France. Must we wait for an unprecedented maritime catastrophe to inspect the state of shell corrosion?
In 1972, there is a report that stated that the state of the munition shells is relatively good. But since then, we are more than 40 years later, we don't know how good or bad is the state of the munition. So that is something we would like to know. Perhaps the shells are still intact, or perhaps quite a lot of them have already corroded.
All North Sea and Baltic coasts are affected, and new sites appear. In the North Sea, over 50 sites are identified. This figure doesn't include many forgotten cases of dumping, so it's impossible to make a precise list of all the dumping sites. France, the country most affected by the submersion, obstructs all attempts to access information on the dumping. Once again in the Belgian archives, I find a letter from the War Ministry advising English and French methods as a source of inspiration. I'm not the first person to delve into these embarrassing papers, as the information memo concerning France has disappeared.
I cannot imagine that France does not have any dump sites, be it for conventional munition or chemical munition. There must be, but we know absolutely nothing about it.
The French army refuses all access to its very secret defense archives, the highest military classification. While scrutinizing navigation maps, I discover over 60 forbidden zones along the French coast, including one in front of Gravelines, where the Belgians dumped German chemical shells. Regional newspaper archives report daily submersions close to Dunkirk, at Boulogne-sur-Mer, at that time the leading French fishing port, but also at Cherbourg, would production of chemical weapons cease after World War I? Not only was everyone expecting World War II to be a chemical war, but from 1934 onwards, the Nazis discover a new family, neurotoxins. They are 10,000 times more effective than the gases used in World War I. The chemical weapons race begins again in between wars. In preparation for the bombing of the Russian army, the Luftwaffe equips itself with these weapons that only the Germans possess. And yet these chemical strikes will never see the light of day, despite the help of Nazi dignitaries who dream of destroying the Red Army after the Stalingrad defeat. German chemical domination should have delayed the end of the conflict, but in the summer of 1945, Germany is defeated without having used its secret weapons. Its immense arsenal is recovered by the Allies. The victors meet at Potsdam, where an embarrassing question is raised. What to do with the 300,000 tons left behind by the losers? Like after World War I, the decision is made to dump these chemical weapons in the sea, but this time in Atlantic gulfs deeper than 1,000 meters. Today, we know that these remote destinations were not adhered to, as the ammunition was submerged in the Baltic Sea at a depth of between 40 and 100 meters. What are the consequences for man and the environment? To find out, I visit the Danish island of Bornholm that suffers the most accidents. It was even easier to dump in the sea, as little was known about the seabed. In ancient times, it was even considered infinite like the sky. Furthermore, don't we also find stars in the oceans? As I approach the island by turboprop, I gaze upon the sapphire blue of the most polluted ocean in the world. After World War II, the island is occupied by the Red Army for 11 months. Before leaving, the Soviets dump tens of thousands of tons of mustard gas seized on the Eastern Front during their infiltration towards Berlin.
I've been fisherman 50 years, in Bornholm and also in North Sea. I buy my first ship in 1972. And after this, I have had ship all the time. So it will be about 45 years about, yeah. And then if you say sinus gas, it seems like syrup, yeah? But I have sea, if you put it direct on the people, yeah? I think it takes maybe 5 minutes for people to die. Yeah. So it's very strong. We take it up in the evening. About 7, 6 o'clock in the evening, yeah. And also we have some bomb, but there's only some steel, yeah. We don't see gas. We take the bump and jump out again, clean fish and, yeah. Go to sleep in the night and wake up maybe 1, 2 o'clock in the night. And then they burn too much around your hands, yeah? And be more and more. And then we take up the tall and go to harbor, but we have 6 hours sailing from the fishing ground to the harbor, yeah? And they're burning more and more, you know? Believe me, you know, the hand was too high, I think. Yeah. All this burning. The skin, everything is off, yeah? So you take some skin from my stomach and put over in my hand. And you can see it now, it's all the way. But all the fingers are working, but the working are good. We have Sweden here, Bornholm here, and Poland here, yeah, and Germany, yeah. And if we go a little bit in, we have Christians Island here, just 12 miles from Bornholm. And the area is about 3 miles east from Kristiansand. It's about the same place as two yellow sheep there. But now we're fishing in this area because there's also good fish here.
The fishermen say that the forbidden zone, the competition between boats, is not as strong. The problem is that trawling scrapes the seabed and disperses the ammunition even more when it doesn't explode. In 50 years, more than 600 accidents have occurred on this underwater powder keg.
I choose the drugs. I'm hepatitis C positive. I'm HIV positive.
The morning starts with the sound of ambulances down here.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Electricity is only 20% of our total energy use. Renewable electricity has not displaced fossil energy in most countries because our consumption increases faster than we can add renewable generation. We now present you an article authored by Mike Joy, a senior researcher at the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. The piece is titled, "The Idea of Green Growth is Flawed." The article has been published by The Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Mike Joy's article. Countries explore ways of decarbonizing their economies. The mantra of green growth risks trapping us in a spiral of failures. Green growth is an oxymoron. Growth requires more material extraction, which in turn requires more energy. The fundamental problem we face in trying to replace fossil energy with renewable energy is that all our renewable technologies are significantly less energy dense than fossil fuels. This means much larger areas are required to produce the same amount of energy. Early this year, data from the European Union showed renewable electricity generation has overtaken coal and gas in 2020. But previous research argued that to replace the total energy, not just electricity, use of the UK with the best available mix of wind, solar and hydroelectricity would require the entire landmass of the country. To to do it for Singapore would require the area of 60 Singapores. I am not in any way denying or diminishing the need to stop emitting fossil carbon. But if we don't focus on reducing consumption and energy waste, and instead fixate on replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy, we're simply swapping one race to destruction with another race to destruction. The carbon causing our climate problem today came from fossilized biology formed through ancient carbon cycles, mostly over the 200 million years of the Mesozoic era, ending 66 million years ago. We must stop burning fossil fuels, but we must also understand that every technology to replace them, while attempting to maintain our current consumption, let alone allowing for consumption growth, requires huge amounts of fossil energy. Carbon reduction without consumption reduction is only possible through methods that have their own massive environmental impacts and resource limitations. To make renewable energy, fossil energy is needed to mine the raw materials, to transport, to manufacture, to connect the energy capture systems, and finally to produce the machines to use the energy. The new renewable infrastructure requires rare earth minerals, which is a problem in itself. But most of the raw materials required to produce and apply new energy technology are also getting harder to find. The returns on mining them are reducing, and the dilemma of declining returns applies to the very fossil fuels needed to mine the declining metal ore. Globally, despite building lots of renewable electricity infrastructure, we have not yet increased the proportion of renewable energy in our total energy consumption. Electricity is only 20% of our total energy use. Renewable electricity has not displaced fossil energy in most countries, because our consumption increases faster than we can add renewable generation. The problems with wanting to maintain industrial civilization are many, but the starkest is that it is the actual cause of our climate crisis and other environmental crises. If we carry on with life as usual, the underlying dream of the green growth concept, we will end up destroying the life-supporting capacity of our planet. The green growth concept is part of a broader and long-running trend to co-opt the words green and environmentalist. Environmentalism emerged from the 1960s as a movement to save the natural world. Now it seems to have been appropriated to describe the fight to save industrial civilization, life as we know it on planet Earth. This shift has serious implications because the two concepts, green growth and environmentalism, are inherently incompatible. Traditionally, environmentalists included people like Rachel Carson, whose 1962 book Silent Spring alerted Americans to the industrial poisons killing birds and insects and fouling drinking water, or environmental organizations like Greenpeace saving whales and baby seals. In New Zealand, being green had its roots in movements like the Save Manapouri campaign, which fought to save ancient native forests from inundation when a hydropower dam was built. Environmentalism had a clear focus on saving the living world. Now environmentalism has been realigned to reduce carbon emissions, as if climate change were our only impending crisis. We must somehow drag ourselves away from our growth paradigm to tackle the multiple crises coming at us. Our only future is one where we consume less, we do less, waste less, and stop our obsession with accumulating. If we keep trying to maintain our current growth trajectory, built on a one-off fossil bonanza, we will destroy the already stressed life-supporting systems that sustain us on this planet. Protecting these and their essential biotic components is true environmentalism, not attempting to maintain our industrial way of life just without carbon. A landmark report released recently put coal and gas on notice. For the first time, the International Energy Agency, the IEA, declared reaching net zero emissions by 2050 means no new investments in fossil fuel supply projects. For Australia, a continent blessed with a bounty of wind and sun, the phasing out of coal and gas investment should be considered a boon. Australia is already deploying wind and solar energy 10 times faster than the global average and still has plenty of unmet renewable potential. But of course, Australia's path to a clean energy economy has not been perfectly smooth. A lack of federal leadership on climate policy and a historical dependence on fossil fuels means the International Energy Agency's roadmap presents a big challenge for Australia. Our latest report recently underscores how big a challenge this is. We assessed Australia's highest emitting energy firms and found none were fully or even closely aligned with global climate goals. Just one firm went even part way, and five appeared to be taking no action at all. Our energy sector report forms part of the Net Zero Momentum Tracker, a project by research organization Climate Works, which works within the Monash Sustainable Development Institute. We assess the commitments of Australia's 20 highest emitting energy companies against the Paris Climate Agreement goals, which include limiting global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius, aiming for 1.5 degrees Celsius. The International Energy Agency's latest work shows to reach those goals, the global energy sector must reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The companies we analyse compromise electricity generators and electricity and gas retailers. Together, they account for almost one-third of Australia's total annual emissions. Each company's commitments were assessed against scenarios we modelled, which map the least cost trajectories with reducing Australia's carbon emissions in line with the Paris Climate Accord goals. We found no large energy company was fully aligned with these trajectories, and most fell well short of them. Six had set carbon emission reduction targets and nine others had taken some action to cut carbon emissions. However, not a single company had commitments that are in line with Australia achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The energy sector is crucial if Australia is to meet the Paris climate goals. Thanks to renewable energy, the sector enjoys some of the easiest and cheapest emission reduction opportunities. And a zero carbon emission energy sector would also help other sectors such as transportation, buildings and industry to decarbonize. At a federal level, the renewable energy target, which ended last year, drove the clean energy shift. New federal policies are now needed to bolster ambitious state and territory policies. This would enable energy market operators and investors to plan a transition aligned with the Paris Climate Accord goals.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.